Are you ready for this? Hello! And as the all-out cricket podcast continues its build-up to the Ashes down under, we deliver high culture and low comedy as we search high and low for your listening satisfaction. We go high with an interview with tall man Steve Finn, we get the lowdown on Trott's preparations for the Ashes, and then we get all high culture on you with a chat about something called a sports law symposium. Woo! And more on your AOC podcast. Well, highs and lows. What better man to talk about cricketers' high and lows than Phil Walker? Let's talk about Ben Stokes. He's had a fantastic time of late in the one-day team, but he also had a rather tumultuous time before that. Take us through it, Phil. Ben Stokes, highs and lows of his career thus far.
Yeah, well, Ben Stokes, what a dramatic turnaround from where he was this time a year or so ago. Heading home on his own on a plane from Melbourne, having been caught out late on the drink with another England Lions player. Didn't help him that Andy Flower was actually on the tour, having popped in to see how his young pups were getting on.
Timing was good.
And Ben was very much not where he needed to be at the time.
Yeah, on a plane.
Yeah. So he headed back home to his missus and his young kid. He was 22 years old, career at Crossroads. One thing that is in his favour is that he's absolutely brilliant and frighteningly talented.
He's 22?
He's
wife now, and child?
Now 23. No, he's still 22, turning 23 soon. Grown
up?
Not wife.
Oh, right. Partner.
Common laws.
Yeah.
But a young kid.
He's no Raheem Sterling.
And, well, far be it for me to say.
Controversy?
We're moving swiftly on from that. Having spoken to a few people at Durham for the piece that we put together for the upcoming magazine, it's slightly cliche maybe, but there was a key kind of crossroads moment for his career, and settling down with his girl and his young lad as well has really focused the mind. And fast forward 7 or 8 months, he's the PCA's Player of the Year, he's the Cricket Writers Player of the Year, and there he is on an Ashes tour.
And he's our Player of the Year.
Yeah.
Do we have a Player of the Year?
He's mine.
He is now.
Well, yeah, there you have it.
From low to a high, he ascended to the rank of wholesome family man. What a fantastic image.
All in 7 months. We've heard from Phil Ultimate Fighter Walker, but we haven't heard from Joe the Hard Man Harmon about your interview in the last couple of weeks. Another absolute gem. Jonathan Trott, was it, Joe?
It was. We were lucky enough to go along to England's Ashes farewell lunch at Lord's, where people go along, wave them goodbye. It's a nice little tradition.
Sounds like
event,
a junket.
Really.
It is our junket.
We don't want to boast here, but not many press get along there. So we had kind of exclusive access to a lot of players there. Phil spoke to KP, which is a good effort.
Wow! Round of applause there.
Very good. We'll come back to that one. That is in the upcoming issue, which is out in 3 weeks from now. But before that, I spoke to Trott about his interesting year. We're talking highs and lows. The nominal in the Champions Trophy, playing out of his skin. All the people who criticised him all kind of shrunk back into the dark.
Mm-hmm.
And then he has
I think that's us, Ross. it's you, Ross.
No, it wasn't me.
No, it's true. No. It was me.
It was you.
I heard that you love him so much for his ability not to give a cliched answer. And it's so rare nowadays. You think he should have his own chat show?
I'm desperate for this to happen.
Let this happen.
I think with enough support, we get some of the England boys on board as well. I like the idea because Trott's on Twitter, he wouldn't know anything about this until he has a chat show. So he wouldn't necessarily see the kind of progression. He'd just be pretty much shoved on TV and off you go.
Yeah.
We had a quick chat around the office today just to think who would you have on there as guests first up. Phil, your suggestion, Alan Titchmarsh?
Well, Titchmarsh for me, yeah.
Trott on Titchmarsh. Very
Titchmarsh
good.
Titchmarsh on Trott.
Titchmarsh can interview Trott.
Oh,
so everyone comes on
the interview. He's the best interviewer I've ever heard. Whenever I've spoken to him before, he turns the question around straight away, throws it right back at you. It's short, succinct, insightful, and terrifying.
He does it very, very well. The first time I spoke to him was a few years back, just after their tour of South Africa, and obviously that was the first time he hadn't got big runs in a series. So I said to him, obviously that series didn't go quite as well as you'd hope, and you kind of just expect him to nod along, but he goes, well, what do you think I averaged? I was like, well, luckily, because I was still fairly green, I actually did my research for this one. So he kind of counted it, and actually, rather sneakily, said an average that I thought was higher, that was higher than he actually got.
Wow, very good. It was like Frost Nixon.
I was quite pleased with myself. And ever since then, and I think most people who have chatted to him a few times, he remembers you, remembers the questions you asked, and he thinks about what you say rather than just trotting out now.
Well,
trotting out the cliches.
It's gone there, it's gone low. Yeah, low culture already.
What better lead-in, listener, to the first exclusive England international cricketer interview on the All Out Cricket Podblast podcast. Yes, it's catchy. We've got Jonathan Trott. Like Carberry Corner before it and Moeen Ali, the Podblast has taken up the flame of Jonathan Trott's chat show.
What's it going to be called?
Trott.
Trott Show.
Trott Show.
Joe?
Hot to Trott.
Hot to Trott, that's the winner.
It's just Trott.
Okay.
Trott. Tweet in. Tell us. Tweet in.
So, Joe, you met with Trott, and we're going to lead into this fascinating interview now. You asked him about what it's like to play back-to-back Ashes and whether you saw it whether he saw it indeed as a 10-match series rather than 2 5-match series. Let's hear what the great man has to say.
Well, I mean, it's obviously quite unique. It's the first time it's happened. So I don't see it as a 10-test series, but I see these next 5 games as, you know, what's the point of doing all that hard work the last 5 games if you're going to let it be undone by not playing well these next 5? So as a team, it's important to forget about the last 5 games,
yeah,
and the scoreline or whatever it is over the 5 games so far, and take each game. It's quite cliche, but you know, these next 5 games are very important, but the last 5 games are gone.
And the Aussie mind games started, well, pretty much before the last series had finished. I saw Ryan Harris the other day saying he thought this got into your head. What do you think about that? Do you just kind of brush it off as the Aussie mind games, or does he have a point there? Is there a chance to reflect on what happened in the last series and have a different approach, perhaps?
That's the thing, as soon as, you know, it's quite difficult because of the last 4 years I've played for the side. We've been very successful, and generally I've been, you know, pretty consistent with my runs. So as soon as something out of the norm happens in cricket, it's quite an obvious thing to notice. I think they bowled really well at the top 3 in general. Actually, I think they had specific plans and bowled really well. So I've spent these last couple of weeks, you know, working on my technique and a few things that I felt I'd slacked on a bit, and also a few bad habits had crept in. So, you know, I feel really confident going to Australia. We had our fitness testing on Friday. I'm the fittest and leanest I've ever been, meaning physically.
Yeah.
That was one of my priorities, stepping on the plane tonight. I had to be at a certain level, not only for myself, but above the team requirements. I had to be fitter than that because I probably wasn't as fit as I probably should have been for a long season, starting in February, going on until the end of September, you know, because we're in New Zealand, start of February, and then straight through to the end of September.
And is that just the nature of playing the whole time and not having a chance to train?
But I don't think it's not being as fit as I am now. I think it's more generally as more of a mental tiredness.
Yeah.
And I wasn't really physically tired, it was more of a mental tiredness, and I just, bad habits crept into my game after a long sort of Champions Trophy, the ups and downs and the final down of losing by 6 runs, and it's quite emotional. It takes a toll when you roll into the next game and you don't realise it, and it's quite draining and weary on you, and especially then a 5-test Ashes series where it's, you know, pretty close nip and tuck in most games, and then it takes a toll on you. So came the one day, as you know, I wasn't exactly in the best of form, and
it's interesting you say that, because the Champions Trophy, you looked in the form of your life.
Yeah,
you were scoring fluently, you were timing the ball brilliantly.
I was feeling good in the Ashes as well.
The way you came out of Trent Bridge on day one.
Yeah, but I had I had the second innings, I had a weird dismissal in the second innings, and then it sort of went down from there a little bit. You know, I got a 50 here and a strange dismissal here, uncharacteristic, I think, the whole series was of the way I played and got out. And so, you know, these things happen. These things are sent to test you, but hopefully, you know, it'll be my turn in Australia, and, you know, I'm going to definitely work as hard as I can, starting whenever I first practice is on Friday or on Saturday or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Well, I've got already done stage one of getting as fit and working at my game, ironing out a few technical things, and feeling really good stepping on this plane and excited about what the next couple of months hold.
Do you think there was a case of your form was so good that you perhaps went out there trying to force it in a way that you hadn't done previously?
No. What happens is a lot of people look what they do is... Again, what you've done is you've looked at a striker compared to what my previous striker is. You've looked at my...
Oh, I'm looking at the way you're playing, the shots you're playing.
But
as
also,
well.
you think, oh, that looks different. So what you do is to confirm your suspicions. You look at it on a piece of paper. Then you look at, oh, what's his average? What's his average this series? Oh, he has a bad series, or he's trying to bat quicker than... See what I mean?
No, I know.
On a piece of paper,
you
can start making, you know, assumptions.
Yeah, which is why we want to speak to you guys to hear.
I don't think I did that at all. It just happened. I think the Australians. No balls to be hit. I hit him.
We can see that in the first game at Trent Bridge. I mean, it looked like for a second you were going to smash the stumps to smithereens, which should have been an exciting way to start the series. You could see you obviously thought there were big runs to be had there.
Yeah, but it was just a silly way to get out. I mean, I didn't need to get out like that or play that shot. So that's what I mean by uncharacteristic. And, you know, hey, I remember at Melbourne when I was on 40 and Ryan Harris took the new ball there. I had Chinese cut one. I went for four. The Trent Bridge went on my stumps. At Melbourne, I went on to get 160 not out, and Trent Bridge only got 40. So sometimes you need a few things to go your way.
Now, noted psychologist and philosopher Alex Adell would like to make a few points about the philosophy and inner workings of the mind of Jonathan Trott.
Well, in my academic research, I've been fascinated by Jonathan Trott's recent response to the question from Joe Harman on the following point. Joe Harman put to him quite sensibly that his strike rate had gone up and yet his average overall had gone down. Trott expertly problematised a seemingly innocuous example of correlation being taken for causation. Trott's strike rate has gone up, but his average has dropped. Ipso facto, when he bats faster, he scores fewer runs. Causation is claimed, but this is a logical fallacy. There is no evidence that they are linked. Trott is at one moment the Moneyball skeptic. He claims authorship over his own narrative. The answer, he says, lies within him. He has simultaneously rejected the problem and yet located the source of the solution within himself. In short, he is intellectually right, but factually wrong. He needs to stop trying to drive full balls outside his off stump. Wow, I don't know who that professor was, but he was clever and funny.
Yeah, he had the same name as you.
He did. Yeah. So Jonathan Trott, that was a really interesting interview. And you're right, he avoids cliche, which is absolutely fascinating.
Astonishing.
Yeah. He clearly thinks about his stats.
He does. Well, this is the irony. He always says, in the past, he said you can't judge anyone on their average. But for someone who doesn't think you can judge someone on their average, he knows a lot about other people's averages. This is he loves his American football, absolutely obsessed with it. He loves stats-based games. But his point, I guess, is that you can't take too much from them. My point on the strike rate was that actually his form was so good, he was kind of letting himself, maybe forcing it a little bit more than he otherwise would do, rather than playing within himself, which is how we've always known him.
Yeah.
But you're right, he gave a considered response. It's obviously something he has thought about, I think, as well.
Yeah.
Well, he played it quite, defensively and sort of cleverly in that manner that he used to play in. And if he answers those questions the way he plays deliveries down under, then we'll be very happy.
Are you saying I should have thrown a short ball down the leg side at him?
Yeah, just to see whether he sort of blasted it into the hands of the wicketkeeper.
All right, well, that's Jonathan Trott, but we are flattered on the show this month to actually have not one but two current England players getting involved. Oh. Hey! Who could refuse to be on the Podblast when you get an introduction like this?
The deal is, we've got this podcast running, which has become quite successful-ish.
Yep.
Successful-ish, Phil? You flatter us, sir. How could Finn resist that?
Oh, you're spoiling us.
Resist, yes. So, Stephen Finn, excitingly, appears here on the Podblast, and we're going to have a quiz. Phil, can you talk us through the basic way in which the quiz is going to work?
Okay, Mr. Stephen Finn, hero of Watford, although he would not attach that title to himself.
Oh, we will do it.
Has picked out a handful of the greats of fast bowling throughout history and is describing them for us and for our listeners without actually giving away the names. or indeed the countries or who they may have played for.
Wow, okay. So in the tradition of the Pod Blast podcast, we haven't discussed what prize the listeners get if they get maybe all three of these.
Tweet them in.
You're going to get something great. If you're lucky, you'll get a nice glass of something fizzy.
I tell you what, we can guarantee we'll throw in a top quality cricket bat.
Well, there we go. Wow, what a quiz. Okay. All right, listener, here is Stephen Finn, live and exclusive. Well, not live, exclusive.
All in one take, this is it.
Oh. On the Pod Blast.
Okay, my first one. He enjoyed predicting series victories long before the series started. He bowled an unerring, nagging line and length consistently, and he tore the heart out of England on many occasions. My second one would be a left-arm swing bowler who also had the capacity to bowl very fast. He worked well in tandem with another very famous, very good, fast swing bowler, and they were experts and masters of reverse swing. My next one, he's probably the grumpiest man currently playing cricket in the world. He's got one very big, long eyebrow, and he doesn't say good morning to me any morning that I walk into the dressing room.
Oh, in one beautiful take, one glorious tracking take, like the beginning of Saving Private Ryan.
Well, thank you, Stephen Finn. You have made my fortnight since the last show, which was the last highlight. All right, well, let's move swiftly on and back to high culture, maybe, Ross.
Ah, yes, high culture. Now, Alex O'Dell was our representative at the Sports Law Symposium, of all things.
Yeah, that's right. Run by the Inner Temple of London and held on Grand Pall Mall at the Institute of Directors. Mm. I was representing a number of bodies there in a sports law symposium. Who should stand up at the back? 6'4" and ruddy-faced, heavy of shoulder and saggy of mouth. But Angus Fraser himself...
You can't describe him like that. That's like describing Jesus as just a bearded man. What did he say, Al?
Well, he raised a question, and we're going to have a new feature here on the podcast. We're going to have a feature where we really wrestle with a major ethical legal problems in the world of cricket, and that's what I think the listener wants.
Yes, every fortnight.
Yes,
dynamite.
Here we go. So here's the first one for you, listener. Angus Fraser asked, with current technology being so good and responsibility being easy to determine for decisions.
Well said.
Can players on the field sue match officials for bad decisions?
Yes.
Let the bomb drop.
Yes.
Joe Harmon suing match officials.
I may be hasty. But yeah, why not? Yeah.
Well, I suppose the question
would
be...
First of all, should you be suing the match officials? Surely you're suing the ICC rather than the individual.
Because they're the employer, because the individual's probably got no money. So you'd want to sue the ICC.
Yeah.
Next thing, of course, is why don't you just sue the opposition for beating you?
Oh.
Just say, you know, when you bowled me then, it cost me a lot of money.
Now, are you being facetious or do you foresee that happening?
I'm using the rhetorical argument of when does it end?
Oh, that one.
Yeah.
We asked you to be Kilroy, not Killjoy. Listen, well, let's talk about some great decisions that could have been overturned. And if they had been, what would the world be like now? Now, one we're all very interested in, Phil Walker has for us.
Well, the butterfly effect of Martin Moxon's inside edge in something like 1988. New Zealand, out there in New Zealand, wasn't being watched by that many people. And not that much by the umps either, because he... middled one, down the fine leg, straight after lunch, I believe. I was 7 at the time, Harmon, by the way, so I don't remember it. I wasn't there, wasn't watching. But he middled
the
one,
quite the picture
he
right
middled
now.
One, down fine, 4 runs, thanks very much. In the middle of a pretty solid innings, opening the batting for England, only his 8th or 9th test or so on, gets to 99, gets out, and he never made 100. He gets 81 not out in the second innings as well of that actual game before the rains come. 2 games later, the West Indies turn up, his career is done for. Now, if he'd made that 100, if that decision had been given and upheld as it should have been, that was 4 runs straight off the face of the bat, then you never know. You know, he may have pushed on. The confidence of getting that ton under your belt could have been a completely different
story. So how old was Moxon at this point? What stage was he at in his career?
Probably mid to slightly late 20s.
27, 28. So that could be. It wasn't like it was late. He was a...
He was a stopgap. That could have been the start of his career.
Yeah, and he was prolific. He was
Martin Moxon, so if you're out there and you're listening, dial 0800 01 23 46 46.
Is that your number?
Cricket lawyers for you.
All right, oh. You're in some yellow,
so there's Martin Moxon. What a good example.
I've got another one that I've just thought of.
Yes.
I'm sure Ed Smith, in his short and extremely intelligent tenure with England.
Yes.
2008.
The South
maybe,
Africa
so,
series.
Yeah. I think he got triggered as well in the final game. I think he middled one off his pad.
That does ring a bell.
Shockingly, it was actually in our magazine a couple of years ago. He was interviewed and he talked about it. And it kind of based, his book Luck is based around that kind of critical moment in his career. You know, if it had been called up correctly, would he have then pushed on and so on and so on. His approach is more kind of philosophical about the whole thing.
Right? Yes. Well, he doesn't know he can sue. But you can, Ed, on 0800 046.
I like the fact that we use the term butterfly effect, because I would just wonder whether if that happened, it would have put into motion a chain of events that ended up with Ed Smith as president. And this and prime minister. Well, and this would be called the Ed Smith Podblast.
Well, that's right. And Ross is actually dealing with the legal idea of causation in tort, which for those of you who enjoy that sort of thing, well, that's it. It's over. So there's one. Martin Moxon, what a good one. Ross, have you got one from 05?
Well, I just wonder about Michael Kasprowitz. He was very gentlemanly about the time, at the time when, was it Harmison?
Yeah.
Bowled.
Jones! That's it. All I took the last bit.
Very good. We'll talk about him later. And he gloves it to the wicketkeeper. Sure, he gloves it. But as you learn, probably when you're about 11 at your local cricket club, if your hand isn't on the bat and you glove it, you're not out, sir. And he was very good about it. He said, you know, I would have been disappointed not to get the decision. But was that decision incorrect? Would the whole causation of the Ashes right now be different if those laws were in place?
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of Glenn McGrath falling over that, what was it, a tennis ball?
Cricket ball.
Should have sued someone. 0800. No, Joe, we've got the last one. Can you help me with this one? Because I'm putting it on to you because I don't really know. Khawaja.
Yeah, well, I thought this one, we mentioned this earlier, but obviously, he might have gone on to make plenty of runs, but actually what we saw from him most of the series, that's another point.
Yeah.
Would you have to prove that you would have actually, you had the potential to go on and do something fantastic?
You would have to get an expert witness. You'd have to get a boycott in the box.
Yeah.
And I can't do a boycott impression.
It's a bit like that time when Jeff Astle, the old footballer, tried to sue the FA for kind of brain damage, having headed the ball for so many years
yeah.
for West Brom and England as a high class number nine. But the argument kind of fell down because it wasn't clear just how stupid he was in the first place.
Yeah.
And whether it had been a gradual degeneration,
so
or whether
the Khawaja
should have been
freed
up.
Khawaja would just have got away with plays.
That could be called the Astle IQ law.
Yeah.
That each person has to measure their intelligence. So if that deteriorates over time, they can blame the local.
It's got the makings of a kind of John Grisham thriller here.
Word.
Well, listener, if you're stupid enough to listen to this podcast, your ears are probably bleeding and your head's exploded. What a wonderful start to our ethical discussions. I do hope that we're going to test the old grey cells a little more in future episodes. Okay, there we go. That's the Law Symposium. Let's get cricket specific.
Hi, Stephen Finn here. When I'm not taking wickets, I like nothing more than to listen to the AOC Podblast podcast.
Well, we're moving on. Let's get cricket specific, Ross, and let's go back into major news at the moment. Ball tampering incident.
Oh, ABDV. ABDV claimed. What did he claim, Al? He was. He had a little word because Faf du Plessis.
What a faff!
Just what he was faffing about with the ball.
This is what
zip.
I love about this. Can I just have a word about
got
the zip?
Five runs just to fill people in. Five runs they got. Docked.
Okay, Faf du Plessis is rubbing the ball on the zip, and he gets caught and he gets fined. And the ICC sort of have to respond. And they put out a press release and they say, well, we were going to ban zips in 2015. Why was it going to take you till 2015?
Yeah.
That's an incredible amount of time to ban
give
a zip.
Enough time to clear out and get some new trainers. Clear
out, new kit, right? Get the Velcro in.
But not to me, Alex, that makes just that's good.
Perfect
sense.
That's
good.
Okay.
Sense.
So good. The
we
zip...
criticise the ICC, but we make a good decision. It's only right
yeah.
that we
the zip ban is locked down. Well done, ICC. That's good stuff. So Faf du Plessis there. He's been caught. First of all, what are our views about that incident before we move on to its more general significance?
Well, I didn't see it. Actually, because I'd lost interest in that game, having been gripped to the one the week before. Mm-hmm. You've got to pick your moments if you're going to indulge in a bit of skullduggery when
yeah.
when, you know, the team's following on and they're going to lose by an innings and plenty anyway, just don't do it. Just do not do it. Don't worry about it.
Why bother?
Why bother at that stage?
Yeah. I mean, there's been ball tampering in the news. I think it's Murray Mint. It could have been any sort of mint. It could have been a Mint Imperial if the man had any taste. But it was the Warwickshire player in the second 11 during this summer. And he got a £5,000 fine for Warwickshire because he was dipping his hand into his pocket where he had a mint.
And you say it could have been any mint. No. The Mint Imperials are considered the number one
choice for the tampon.
Do you have to lubricate the mint first to get it a bit tacky?
I think it was Dirt's
sweet of choice was the snakes, wasn't he? So the Australian players love a bit of silly snakes.
Okay.
Oh. He said they're both tasty and create a good...
This is Dirk Nannis, who wrote about this subject 2 or 3 months ago in the magazine.
I like the idea of having a pocket full of nerds. Mm. And it's coming out and there's the ball just having sort of bits of nerds stuck to it.
I wouldn't be able to resist. I'd pick one off.
And it'd be on camera. I know it would.
Ravi Bo would have one.
It'd be delicious.
I think what you're saying there is it an okay punishment? Because you get your pocket all sticky. That's punishment enough, isn't it?
It sticks your pocket together.
Yeah.
Do you know what the most... if it's not controversial enough there was ball tampering, then maybe certain comments by ABDV afterwards made it a little bit more controversial, because I'm very interested in what he said afterwards. He said, quote, "We're not the team that scratches the ball." We're not a team that scratches the ball.
When England were there last time, there was the thing, wasn't there? Broad and Anderson were accused of standing on the ball.
I tell you what, Joe, stat attack. Incredible memories.
Michael Vaughan was actually very critical of Broad and Anderson at the time. And I don't think he said they're ball tampering, but he was basically saying, don't let them be in a position where they... Don't put yourself in a position where they can accuse you.
Yeah.
So just stop playing around with the ball with your feet.
ABDV, at the time of that incident, 2010, said, quote, Broad had been a little bit naughty. Because apparently he'd stood on the ball and it started reverse swinging afterwards. So do you think when ABDV is making this comment saying, we're not the team that scratches the ball, he's talking about England?
I think he is. But what he did there as well, what he did a few years back, was cowardly. Because he's not making an accusation that England can deny. He's just putting it out there. England aren't going to come out and deny something that hasn't been formally put to them.
Yeah.
So he's kind of just letting the rumours sit there without actually doing anything about
it. I was doing a little reading up on it. You can remember these things. I had to read about it. And they had until the morning of the next day's play to make an official complaint. Mm. And they didn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Case closed. Particularly because I'm an England fan.
South Africa are no stranger to the darker arts either. I mean, the way that they stitched up Peterson last summer was a classic piece of skullduggery, and they kind of walked away with it.
That's interesting you should say that, because I think sometimes, and we're going to describe ourselves as outsiders for a second here, Ross.
Sure.
Although we very much feel like insiders the temple of cricket. But
the inner temple of
I don't Dune. Really know exactly what the South Africans did to Peterson, or are supposed to have done to Peterson. I know there was a bit of texting. Who initiated that texting?
I think we'll have to wait for the book, which won't be too far along.
I mean, you had the interview with him.
Yeah, and he actually said those words, those exact words.
I was stitched up.
No. It all comes out in the book.
Interesting. Oh. What book? Is there a book on the way?
The KP book, as soon as he retires, which will be in 15 years' time, probably about 6 months, he will release the book and it will blow it all.
Will it be as positively received as Alex Ferguson's?
We can only hope.
Lovely. Okay, well, that's ball tampering. What a major issue in the game. Ross, I can see you leaning in. Anything more to say about ball tampering? Sure.
Those little accusations have followed England around a little bit. They seem to be the team.
George Bailey as well in the ODI series last summer as well, who said, pretty surprised it's going after about 8 overs.
No
smoke without fire, is there?
But South Africa have been the ones that have been done.
I'm a lawyer, no smoke without fire.
South Africa have been done.
I'm a criminal lawyer, no smoke without fire.
But my heart tells me, let's forget about all this. My head tells me, let's get T-shirts with 5 runs deducted on. Let's never stop going on about it. Never let them forget.
I don't mind scrapping. It's good.
For our international listeners who really want to know what's happening in the off-season of the county championship here in England, we've got Northants news. Phil Walker.
Yet again, your resident Northants expert. Jackson Burr signs.
What a signing.
That's a great signing.
It is a great signing. He's a brilliant bowler, I think.
Tell us why.
Uh,
All right, having said that, I think he might be a bit brittle. but I think technically, skill-wise, I think he's a brilliant bowler. Saw him bowl in Australia a year or two ago when he first emerged. He's got a frighteningly good first-class record. He looks a bit kind of wiry and possibly a bit brittle, but I reckon if he's fit, and speaking to Peters about it a couple of weeks ago, he said, yeah, if he's fit, he'll be dynamite.
His record is sensational since he's come on to, to stir Sheffieldshire cricket. He's been unbelievable.
It was funny against England because he kind of drifted away second innings, but he bowled one particular ball to
Cook, which
he left, just a break back coming in.
I thought that was a good spell, actually.
Yeah, he did bowl really well.
It was that morning, wasn't it? Jackson